Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. I don't know how many people have got Bibles open. Can I have a show of hands as to how many people have got Bibles open? Right, that's excellent. You know, obviously, as one gets further back to the hall, the principles of darkness increase, and so. I leave it for you to work out the symbology of who's sitting where. We do hope that during the course of the study that all will be enlightened in due course with the advent of some powerful changes. In Genesis chapter 17 then, which is where we're going to start our record this evening, as our brother Klaus has read for us in those first 22 verses, we have the next stage of the story of Abraham and Sarah. By the way, someone said to me, you know, you oughtn't to have stories, you know. You see, the word story doesn't mean make-believe, does it? A story is a story, but you can have a true story. This is a true story. There's no make-believe here. This is the real story of their lives. But, you see, just as there are chapters in a story, so there are chapters in the lives of these people, you see. And we're going to go through, therefore, the next part of the story, which is the next chapter, which also happens to be the next chapter of Genesis. Now, you see, where we left them on the occasion of our study this morning was that Abraham and Sarah had learnt, in the words of a New Testament quotation, the children of the flesh, these are not the children of the promise. That's what they learned, wasn't it? The children of the flesh, these are not the children of the promise. And they'd had to learn that now through bitter experience. And you see, Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1 says, and when Abram was 90 years old and 9, Yahweh appeared to Abraham. So, you see, we're told in chapter 16 and verse 16, at the end of that chapter, that Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abraham. So he was 86 when Ishmael was born, but 99 in Genesis chapter 17 verse 1. So you see, Abraham and Sarah had now had to wait for a further 13 years for the fulfillment of the promise. You see, remember one of the lessons we learned in chapter 16 was that they hadn't learned to wait on God. God says, I'll teach you to wait on me, all right. They had to wait another 13 years before God moved to fulfill that promise. And you see, I think that two things happened in those 13 years. First of all, Romans chapter 4 tells us, and by the way, Romans 4 is a commentary on Genesis 17. Romans 4 tells us that by this chapter, both Abraham and Sarah had dead bodies. In other words, they could not produce children, neither of them. Their bodies were as good as dead, says the record in Romans 4. And you see, during that 13 years, therefore, all earthly hope, all natural hope of ever being able to raise the promised seed by natural means had now been extinguished. Both of them had dead bodies, says Romans 4, and therefore in those 13 years they had now learned to wait absolutely on God. There was no other way but to wait on Him. And of course the other thing that they'd had to do during those 13 years is they'd had to endure the consequences of their own sin in Genesis 16, hadn't they? As now a little child ran around the household. And Hagar, of course, being the woman she was, would still not lose opportunity to make the point that that was her boy. But she would encourage him to run to Abraham, wouldn't she? And she'd say to Sarah, you see how his father loves him. And the little boy would run, the lad would run to his father, to Abraham. And there was further distress and further trial, you see, in that house. How easy it would have been for a Peninnah-Hannah situation to develop between these two women during these 13 difficult years. But now they're over. And finally, says the record in Genesis 17 verse 1, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be thou perfect. I am Almighty God, and of course that's the title, El Shaddai, isn't it? I am El Shaddai. So, you see, although it was Yahweh that appeared, he calls himself, he entitles himself El Shaddai on this occasion. Now, what does El Shaddai mean? Well, it has to do with, of course, the principles of power and might. But that power and might is channeled in a rather special way. I'm just going to read another couple of references for you in terms of the use of El Shaddai. In Genesis 28 and verse 3, we read these words, "And El Shaddai bless thee, and make thee fruitful, and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people." So El Shaddai in Genesis 28 has relationship to the building of a family and the multiplication of offspring. In Genesis 49, we read in the 29th verse, in the blessings of Jacob upon his sons, it says there, in fact in the 25th verse it is, Genesis 49 verse 25, it says, "Even by the ale of thy father who shall help thee, and by Shaddai who shall bless thee with blessings, blessings of the breasts and blessings of the womb." So El Shaddai is really used here in the sense of he who has the power to nurse a family. That's who El Shaddai is. And of course there's an interesting reference in the New Testament which we won't turn to, but you might like to take a note of. In the 2 Corinthians chapter 6, the Apostle Paul on one occasion exhorts the brethren that they might leave the world and come out to God. And he says, "Wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and I will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty." El Shaddai. 2 Corinthians 6 verse 18. So you see, the term El Shaddai, we believe, that's used here in Genesis chapter 17, has relationship to God in the context of him being a nursing father to a young family. Later on, of course, in the history of the nation, he would be known as Yahweh, the covenant God of the fully developed seed. But not yet. First, the seed has to be begun, and it would be begun by the operation of God acting as a nursing father, that first special, unique, miraculous son, the promised seed, might be brought forth. "I am El Shaddai," says Almighty God in Genesis 17 verse 1 as he appears to Abram. And then he says in that first verse, he says, "Walk before me and be thou perfect." Now you see, when God says to Abram to be perfect, he doesn't mean perfect in the sense of sinless. He means to be upright or sincere. But you see, that phrase, "walk before me and be thou perfect," you see, I think it would have taken Abram's mind back to an earlier occasion. What episode would that remind Abram of? "Walk before me and be thou perfect." You see, that phrase came from another man, from an earlier age. Who was the man who walked before God and was perfect and upright in his generations? And the answer is Noah. And what did God do with Noah? God made a new beginning through Noah and his sons. And now God was going to do the same through Abraham and Sarah. A new beginning was going to be made. And therefore he takes Abraham's mind back, as it were, as he asks him to walk before God in that state of perfect sincerity, as did Noah of old. And then in the second verse of Genesis 17, God says, "I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly." "I will make my covenant," he says. Now it's interesting that in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 2, when God says that he would make a covenant, it's not the normal word for making a covenant. The normal word is berit in the Hebrew, which means, of course, to cut a covenant. But that's not the word used here in Genesis 17. The word used here is Nathan, which means really to institute or to grant or to implement the covenant. You see, the covenant was made in Genesis 15. The covenant was cut in Genesis 15. But what God is saying now in Genesis 17 is, "Now, Abram, the time has come for us to Should I have stopped, brother? The time has come, says God, for us to make a covenant. We've already cut the covenant, but now the time has come for that covenant to be established between us, says God. And what he says in the second verse, it's a marvellous thing, you see. What he says is this. He says, I'll make my covenant between me and thee. And when the lights do finally come on, since we've had an earnest of that possibility already, when the lights finally come on, you'll find that that's a key phrase used in Genesis 17, between me and thee. It's used in verse 4. It's found again in verse 7. I will establish my covenant between me and thee. It's found in verse 10. This is my covenant between me and you. And again in verse 11. It says at the end of the verse there, this shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. And you see, I think what God was saying was this. Between me and thee. He wasn't just simply saying, well, this is going to be a covenant between Abraham and God. I think what God was saying was, Abraham, this is going to be, this covenant, this, the fulfillment of this promise is going to be between you and me. I'm going to be involved in its fulfillment, says God. You and me together, Abraham, we're going to fulfill this promise, and this son that you've longed for is about to be brought forth, and I'm going to be personally involved in ensuring it. In other words, God was going to intervene in their lives. Abraham was going to be the father of the lad, but in another sense, God was going to operate upon them, and the very fatherhood of God would be involved in the production of the seed. It reminds us of Ephesians chapter 3, doesn't it, in verses 14 and 15, when it says there, in the words of the Apostle Paul, he calls upon God, he says, in whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. Remember that phrase? In whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. God is the Father of us all. And his promise to Abraham on this occasion was that he would be personally involved. God was to be personally involved in the fulfillment of this promise. Well, what a promise that was. In fact, verse 3 tells us that as a result of this promise, it says Abram fell on his face. He fell on his face and God talked with him. You see, not only, I don't think he just fell on his face because of reverence, although that no doubt was the case. Not just because of humility, but you see, I think Abram felt a deep sense of unworthiness. He felt absolutely amazed that despite all of their mistakes and all of their weaknesses, that God was still prepared to fulfill that promise with them. Abram felt terribly humbled by that. He fell on his face as God talked with him. And as God talked with him, he said these words in the fourth verse. He says, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. A father of many nations. Actually, the word nations that's used in the fourth verse of Genesis 17 is the word goyim. And the word goyim is the word normally used of the Gentiles. So this promise, you see, to Abraham that he was to be a father of many nations was going to reach out ultimately, starting with just this one boy, but it was going to reach out to embrace both the Jew and the Gentile. Now, why was that promise so extensive that both Jew and Gentile eventually would be caught within its embrace? Well, I think for the very reason that God has mentioned is that, you see, God himself was to be involved in Abraham's fatherhood. And as the creator of all things, the principles of God's salvation are absolutely universal. They extend to all. And so through this one son would eventually come to Abraham, fatherhood of many nations, who would be caught within the embrace and within the wonder of these promises. And so verse 5 says, neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee. Now, some of you may know this, but it's interesting, you see, because You see, we ask ourselves the question, then, how was this to be? How was the promise to be fulfilled? How was Abram with his dead body and Sarah with her dead body, how were they going to be empowered and enabled to bring forth this child? And the answer lies in the fifth verse. Because you see, it says, "Thy name shall no longer be Abram, but Abraham." Now, some of you may know that the word Abram in the Hebrew has four consonants. But to his name was now going to be added a fifth consonant or letter. And his name is going to go from Abram to Avraham. And it's the H that's going to be added. It's an extra consonant. But as far as Abraham was concerned, it was a fifth letter that was to be added to his name. Now you see, the number 5 in the Bible represents, well, it represents divine grace. It stands for the principle of grace. But I think we can extend it further, you see. It specifically, I think, represents grace in this sense. The grace of God in imparting strength to those in human weakness that they might be made strong by Him. Those that are strengthened out of their weakness are those especially who are the recipients of divine grace. And you see, I think the lesson of this chapter was God's grace was going to intervene in their lives in order that this child might be brought forth. It was all going to be the operation of grace. So of course you say, well, that's fine, but you know, that's only one letter really. Actually, the number 5's, I think, quite significant in this story, perhaps more significant than we realise. You see, firstly, Abram's name was going to be expanded from 4 consonants to 5. But the letter that was added to his name was the letter Hay in the Hebrew, which just happens to be the 5th letter in the Hebrew alphabet. Not only is it the 5th letter in the Hebrew alphabet, but it is, of course, the dominant consonant in the name of God Himself. Yahweh. YHWH. And that H, you see, represents the intervention of God's grace into the life of Abraham that he might be empowered to bring forth this seed. And it just so happens that the letter H that was added to his name has a numerical value of, 5. And of course, this was going to be the fulfillment of a covenant that had been made already in Genesis chapter 15. And you might like to take a note that in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 9, it outlines the sacrifices that were used to make up that covenant that they had made between them. Do you know how many animals there were in the covenant? 5 animals. Of course, the whole promise concerned the seed, didn't it? The promised seed to come. Do you know how many times the word seed is mentioned in this chapter? 5 times. And Genesis 17 is a manifestation of God to Abraham. There was a whole series, you see, of manifestations by which God communicated with his friend Abram. There was actually 8 of them. There's 8 divine manifestations in the record to Abram. You'd never guess which one this is, would you? Why? This is the 5th time that God has been manifested to Abram. Grace was going to operate in the life of the patriarch in order that that child might be brought forth. Do you reckon that's right? Come and have a look at Romans chapter, well, those of you that can, come and have a look at Romans chapter 4. Now remember that Romans 4 is a commentary on Genesis 17. And the crucial thing that would make all the difference in order that this child might be brought forth was the operation of divine grace, that out of their own weakness they might be made strong by his intervention in their lives. Now look what Romans chapter 4 says, and reading from perhaps verse 13 by way of connection. Here's the inspired apostolic comment upon Genesis 17. For the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of none effect, because the law worketh wrath. For where no law is, there is no transgression. Therefore, he says, verse 16, therefore it is of faith that it might be by grace, to the end that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all, as it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations. And the Apostle Paul quotes from Genesis 17, that it might be by grace, says the Apostle. Yes, that's the lesson, I'm sure, of Genesis chapter 17. And you see, the principle was this. You can have all the faith in the world, but without God's grace, you cannot be saved. And without the grace of divine strength intervening in Abram's life and in Sarah's life, this child could never be born. And so that was the promise that God made to them, is that he would personally intervene in that way. And so coming back to the record in Genesis chapter 17 then, God says in the 6th verse, I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. And so they would too, because from Abram would spring the royal Davidic line, from Abraham eventually would come Messiah the Prince. And reaching out into the goyim of the age to come, there would of course be the aristocracy who will rule with Christ in the kingdom age, and they're all going to be counted as Abram's seed as well. Yes, kings were to come out of Abraham, all beginning with this first child that would be born. And verse 7 says, I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And so this promise, which by the way was really to natural Israel, involved two things. It was a covenant of possession, I will give thee the land, and it was a covenant of fellowship, I will be their God. And both those things were promised to the nation of Israel in a natural sense. They would enjoy a special relationship with God that only Israel would ever have. And we notice that the promise was, in verse 8, for an everlasting possession. And the everlasting possession of verse 8 is matched by the everlasting covenant of verse 7. Only an everlasting covenant, you see, can promise an everlasting possession. Now, verses 9 to 14, we're going to actually, in the interest of time, we're going to actually move over those. But we're going to extract, I think, just one vital principle from them before we move on to the 15th verse. Now, you'll probably know that verses 9 to 14 in Genesis chapter 17 is all about circumcision. It's about the principle and the ritual of circumcision. And I really just want to make a couple of comments that I think are pertinent to this story in terms of the meaning of those verses. We say, of course, that circumcision represents the cutting off of the flesh, the repudiating of carnal thinking in our lives. That circumcision is the equivalent in the Old Testament of baptism in the New, whereby we seek to put to death the old way of the flesh and the old thinking of the flesh. And all of those things are true. But I tell you what I think circumcision really stood for in Genesis chapter 17. It's really very simple. You see, this chapter is all about the promise of a son. A son to be born to a man and a woman who are past being able to have a child. And God says, I'm going to intervene, Abram, in your life. I'm going to give you my strength in your weakness. I'm going to bestow my grace upon you. I'm going to be El Shaddai, a nursing father. It's going to be between you and me. I'm going to be involved in this, Abram. And in order to teach Abram that this child was not to be born by the principles of natural procreation, he is circumcised in the very context of a promise being made to him that he was going to father a child. And when a man's been circumcised, well, that's the one time when he really can't father a child. Now, I'll tell you what, that's exactly how the New Testament takes it up. You see, come and have a look at Acts chapter 7. Whatever else circumcision may mean, I think the lesson to Abram was that he was in fact being brought to Sarah's level. Her body was incapable of producing a child. And I believe that so was Abraham symbolically in the episode of chapter 17 when he undergoes the principle of circumcision. Now have a look at Acts chapter 7. You see, this is the famous speech of Peter, isn't it? Stephen. This is Stephen's great speech. Now look what he says about circumcision. In Acts 7 and verse 7 he says this. He says, "And the nation to whom they shall be in bondage will I judge, says God, and after that they shall come forth and serve me in this place." Now listen to these words. "And he gave him the covenant of circumcision, and so Abraham begat Isaac." You see how those ideas are brought together? He gave him the covenant of circumcision, and so begat Isaac. But a circumcised man can't beget a son. You see, this was going to be the operation of divine intervention. The intervention of God. This child, in a sense, if you like, was not to be the product of his flesh. God was going to share in the birth of that child. And as if to remind Abram of that fact, he circumcises him. And so he begat Isaac. Romans chapter 4 again. Have a look at Romans chapter 4. And see how Romans 4 brings together the principle of circumcision and fatherhood. So that clearly the fatherhood that is being spoken of is something beyond the ordinary, resting in fact on the power of the operation of God. Now you see, Romans chapter 4 says this in verses 11 and 12. Romans 4 says, "And Abram received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had yet being uncircumcised. He received the sign of circumcision that he might be the father." You see that? He received the sign of circumcision that he might be a father. What a wonderful juxtaposition of ideas. It's a paradox, you see. He who was incapable of producing children was to have children through the operation of God upon him. And so coming back to Genesis chapter 17, I think that's what circumcision stood for in this particular story, as this couple are both now brought to a common level of complete inability, as it were, to have this child in order that the operation of God's grace upon them might be seen. Now come to verse 15, because now in the 15th verse, we come to the involvement now of Sarah in the story. And you see what verse 15 says. It says, "And God said unto Abram, As for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. And I will bless her, and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations, and kings of people shall be of her." Remarkable, you see. So now Sarah is brought into the promise in just the same way that Abraham has. And what's the change as far as Sarai is concerned? Why her name is to be changed. And how is her name to be changed? Why the letter H is to be added to her name as well. The same operation of divine grace that was to work upon Abraham was to work upon his wife as well. And so the fifth letter is added again. Remarkable. And so God, you see in this verse, now concentrates Abraham's attention upon the fact that his wife was equally involved in this promise together with him. You see, I think this was the one thing that Abraham had never really understood, that Sarah was in this together with him. Now let me show you that. Ooh. In terms of exactly how that unfolds.
It's really quite lovely. Now look at this.
Behold, my covenant is with thee. Now here's the promise made to Abram. First of all, neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Avraham. And the divine H of grace is added to the patriarch. And thou, says the record, thou shalt be a father of many nations. And not only a father of many nations, but I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, so that eventually, says the record, kings shall come out of thee. These are the terms by which Abraham is exhorted and encouraged in verses 5 and 6 of this story in Genesis chapter 17. And now in verses 15 and 16, God focuses the attention of Abraham upon the fact that his wife is intimately involved in the fulfillment of this promise. In fact, she is equally involved in the outworking of this promise. Now, just look at this. It's lovely. First of all, he says, as for thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. And so her name is changed in just the same way that her husband's name was changed. And then it says, just as of Abraham it said, thou shalt be a father of many nations. In Genesis chapter 17 and verse 16 it says of Sarah, and she shall be a mother of nations. And just as it had said of Abraham, I'll make thee exceeding fruitful, of Sarah it says, I will bless her. And of course the blessing that was to come upon her was the blessing of receiving strength to conceive seed in order that she might be fruitful. And then of Abraham it was said, and I will make nations of thee. And it says in verse 17 to Sarah, and I will give thee a son also of her. And through that son, of course, would come those nations. And finally it was said to Abraham, kings shall come out of thee. And Genesis chapter 17 and verse 16 says, kings of people shall be of her. Now just look at that, you see. They were in it together, weren't they? They were absolutely bound together in the fulfillment of this promise to come of the wonderful child that was to be born. And you see, I think this just hit Abraham. I think he was absolutely flabbergasted. He'd never really understood this before. That his wife and he were absolutely in this story together. In fact, what the record goes on to say in verse 16, it says, I will bless thee, and I will give thee a son of her. But Rotherham translates the phrase in verse 16, yea, moreover, he says, I will give from her to thee a son. Just listen to those words carefully. I will give from her to thee a son. You see, it's almost as if God says that Abraham's got nothing to do with it. I will give from her to thee. It's almost like a virgin birth, you see. And the operation of God was going to be upon Sarah in just the same way that he was going to operate upon the life and upon the body of Abraham. And verse 17 tells us that Abram fell on his face. Isn't that remarkable? He'd only just got up, he fell on his face in verse 3. He must have got up at some stage. Now he falls on his face again, says verse 17. Why did he fall on his face this time? Well, you see, I think he fell on his face in the 17th verse because he had just understood the principle of Sarah's complete involvement in this promise. He'd never, ever really grasped that before. And you see, as soon as Abraham understood that, he would have recognized the folly and the foolishness of what they'd done with Hagar. How could they ever build the house of Abraham by means of another woman when this was his wife and this was the woman that had to bear that promised seed? She's in it with you, says God. And Abraham fell on his face in sheer wonder at the understanding of that principle of their mutual involvement in that promise. You know how we know that? Because that's what verse 17 says. Abraham fell upon his face and he laughed and he said in his heart, now listen to what he said, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old, and shall Sarah, that is 90 years old, bear? And he brings the two of them together, you see, in the fulfillment of the promise. Are we really both going to have this child, he says? Yes, the miracle of sonship was to involve a divine visitation upon both of these older people, really, 100 years old and 90 years old, as the record says. And then verse 18 says that Abram said unto God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." Now that's an interesting thing, actually. "Oh, that Ishmael might live." It's almost a strange thing, isn't it, for Abram to say, in the middle of this promise that he's just been given about the birth of his own son, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." Now, I don't think for a moment that Abram was pleading for Ishmael instead of Isaac. He was filled with joy at the thought that Isaac was going to be born. He wasn't asking for Ishmael to take Isaac's place, but you see, I think what Abram was saying was this, that he knew that if Isaac was to be born, and that he was to be the promised seed, then Ishmael would immediately be relegated to servant status. And so he prays to God that God might find some place in his purpose for Ishmael. And God answers that. God says later on that he will do that. See, it's an interesting principle of Abraham, you see, Abraham had care for other people. No sooner is he promised Isaac than he's concerned about Ishmael. "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." In a later chapter, he prays for Lot. He had a care for other people. But you see, the one thing that Abraham had to develop, the one care that Abraham had to develop, was a care for Sarah, his wife. The funny thing, you know, with husbands is they can often show the spirit of care to everyone else other than their wife. They spend time with the children. They'll teach Sunday school. They'll sit on the gospel proclamation committee. They'll be an arranging brother. They'll attend all sorts of important meetings in the ecclesia. And the one thing that they won't do, and the one person that they won't spend time with, is their wife. Funny thing, you know. Aren't men strange creatures? It's just the way they are. And you see, Abraham was going to need to spend time with Sarah. Because you see, I think what happens in this story is that Abraham, in fact, he really thinks ahead. His faith leaps ahead. I think Abraham's convinced. He believes that the child's really going to come. He's absolutely convinced. I'm going to show you why I think that in a minute. But you see what the record says. He says, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." God says, verse 19, "Sarah thy wife shall bear a son." You think about your wife, says God. You show care for her. She's the one who needs your help right now, your development right now, your encouragement right now. Sarah thy wife. She's involved, Abram. But she needs your help as a husband. Actually, the verse goes on to say, verse 19, God said, "Sarah thy wife shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac." Yitzhak. Actually, that's interesting. "Thou shalt call his name." You see, in the case of Ishmael, the mother had the naming of the child, didn't she? But in the birth of Isaac, the father had the naming of the child. And what was the child to be named? The child was to be named Yitzhak, which of course means, anyone know what Yishak means? It means laughter. And I believe that this child was named on the basis of the laughter of faith that Abraham gave in the 17th verse. When it says that he fell upon his face and laughed, I don't think it was the laugh of unbelief, brothers and sisters. I believe it was the laugh of absolute faith. And I'll tell you why. I've got five reasons why I think that that's the case. The first thing is that Romans 4, which is a commentary on the thinking and the feeling of Abraham in Genesis 17, says that in this episode, he believed in hope, he staggered not, he was strong in faith, he gave glory to God, he was fully persuaded. This is not the laughter of an uncertain man, says Romans 4. This was a man who had absolute conviction that what God had promised, he would indeed fulfill. The second thing is that it says that Abraham fell on his face. And you see, I think that was the action of instinctive prostration in wonder and thanksgiving. He didn't fall on his face because he was uncertain. He didn't fall on his face because he was doubtful. He fell on his face because he was joyful with certainty. And we know, of course, point number three is that he used the new name of Sarah immediately, thus indicating his deep appreciation that they were to embrace the covenant blessing together, and his use of that name and his understanding of that principle of their mutual involvement was an understanding of faith that it would indeed all happen. You know, in John chapter 8 and verse 56 it says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and was glad." Do you remember that passage in the New Testament? Well, what's interesting about that is that in the Old Testament, so therefore we believe that this is probably the place that John 8 verse 56 is alluding to. "Your father Abraham rejoiced." That's the laughter of faith. And so this son of promise was to be named Isaac, laughter, in commemoration of Abraham's glad acceptance of the divine promise. Yes, I think Abraham was absolutely convinced that it was going to happen. And his son was named in commemoration of that principle, you see. Now the question is, what convinced Abraham? Why was Abraham so sure? Because, by the way, Sarah wasn't. I don't think she was sure at all. Abraham was, but I don't think Sarah was. And you see, I think this is one of these things where a man is different to a woman. A man sees things differently. You see, what Abraham saw was he saw right to the end. He saw the son. And he was absolutely convinced that that son now could come and would come as a result of the divine interposition in their lives. But Sarah saw all the problems and difficulties on the way. That's how women think, actually, isn't it? You know, men have a much better objective sense of seeing an end. But a woman's built in a way that she sees every valley and every mountain, every trough on the way. And a man sometimes seems to be able to skip over the top of the mountains. A woman doesn't do that. She's got to go down every valley and up every tunnel. Down there. She does. She's built that way. She's different. And Sarah's not ready yet for the faith that's needed on this occasion. I'll show you an interesting parallel. Have a look at this. In Colossians chapter 1, I think we have an allusion to Genesis chapter 17. Colossians 1 says, "Walk worthy of the Lord." Genesis 17 said, "Walk before me." Colossians says, "Being fruitful in every good work." Genesis says, "I'll make thee exceeding fruitful." Colossians says, "And increasing in the knowledge of God." Genesis 17 says, "I will multiply thee exceedingly." And that word multiply is translated increase in Isaiah 51. Colossians says, "Being strengthened with all might." Genesis 17 says, "I'll be an ale unto thee and to thy seed." Colossians says, "Unto all patience and long suffering." And isn't that the very lesson that Abraham and Sarah had learned in this episode when he was 90 years old and 9 and they'd learnt to wait for another 13 years on the father? "And let it be with all joyfulness," says Colossians. And Genesis says, "Abraham laughed in his heart as a result of this promise that had been made." "Giving thanks unto the Father," says Colossians, "and Abraham fell upon his face to do just that. So that we might be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light," says Colossians. And Genesis says, "I will give unto thee the land." And in Psalm 105 it calls the land the lot of their inheritance. And what was the key to all of this in Genesis 17? It was promised by El Shaddai. And Colossians says, "God's made us meet for all of that." Now you see that word "meet" there. You know that word "meet" in Colossians chapter 1 is only found twice in the New Testament. It's found once in Colossians 1, and once in the 2nd of Corinthians 3, where it's translated sufficient. God has made us sufficient for whatever is necessary. But it just so happens that that word sufficient is the word that the Septuagint version uses to translate the phrase El Shaddai in the Old Testament. God's sufficient for everything. Abram believed that. In the words of a wonderful passage in the 2nd of Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 9, where these words are to be found: My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. And you see, I think that this was the point, is El, the all-sufficient one, was the one that Abraham now absolutely believed in. He was convinced that that powerful God, El Shaddai, could perform everything that he'd said that he would promise to him. He believed in the all-sufficient power of that God. I don't think Sarah did, not yet. She wasn't ready, not yet. And Abraham's faith, I think, leapt ahead on this occasion. And so it was left for him now to try and encourage his wife. And you see, verse 21 of Genesis 17 goes on to say, it says, But my covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time next year. My covenant will I establish with Isaac. Do you know, brothers and sisters, that that covenant is first made in Genesis chapter 15, isn't it? The covenant is cut between Abraham and God in Genesis 15. Do you know that the word covenant is used once in Genesis 15? Once. Guess how many times the word covenant is found in Genesis 17? You might have a guess. 12? No. Now think about it. It's already been used once. By the way, it's never used again after Genesis 17. So whatever you add to the one time it's been used in Genesis 15 when the covenant is first cut is the final number that you'll get to. So what do you reckon the number might be in this chapter? 4? No. 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 11? No. 13. Excellent. 13. Finally, Klaus, after running through virtually every... It was a process of time, really, wasn't it? So you see, the word covenant concerning this couple is found 14 times in the record. You know what that is? You ought to be careful with Bible numbers, I know. But isn't that 7 times 2? Isn't 7 really the number of the covenant? But you see, this is 7 times 2. Abraham and Sarah were in this thing together, weren't they? They're joined together in embracing the hope of this covenant. But you see, what the verse says is that Sarah shall bear thee a son at this set time next year. That's 12 months away, by the way. So the child's not going to be born yet, not quite yet. There's further development needed, you see, and the development was needed in Sarah. And I think that Abraham here was given time in order that he might now help his wife, develop his wife, to that final point of faith that was needed before the child could be conceived. And Abraham had to learn, brothers and sisters, the principle of sacrifice. Now, we won't turn up the 1st of Peter chapter 3, but you'll notice that these are where the words come from. And I believe that in the 1st of Peter 3 that Peter has in mind, again, the example of Abraham. And so he says, Likewise ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honour unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace... Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. Is that not the fulfillment really of Genesis 17? Actually, it's interesting, by the way, the husband was to dwell with his wife. Dwell with them, says Peter.
Now you see, I've said here that Abraham shared his tent with Sarah. Now you might think that's funny, but you see, it's actually exactly what happens. Because in the next chapter, you see, what happens is this. Abraham's sitting at the tent door, and some strangers arrive. So he goes rushing out to meet the strangers. And then he comes rushing back into the tent, and he says to his wife, I want you to get some food ready. And then he takes the food, and he goes outside, and while he goes outside, she comes and stands in the tent door. They lived in the tent together. They dwell together in the tent. Now that's interesting, because later on, you see, in the divine record, it says that when Isaac got married, it says that he brought Rebekah, his wife, into his mother's tent. So Sarah had her own tent. But in Genesis chapter 18, hard on the heels of this episode in Genesis 17, they are dwelling together in the same tent, exactly as Peter says. And they were to dwell according to knowledge. And I think that's the point now, you see, is that Abraham has to develop a sacrificial spirit towards helping his wife, that her knowledge and her faith might increase to the same point that his has already reached. Giving honour unto the wife, isn't this the chapter where he immediately calls her by her new name? Recognising that she's the weaker vessel, he had to have sympathy for her situation in this particular regard. And as being heirs together. And if ever there was a lesson that Abraham had learned in Genesis 17, it was that his wife was fully involved with him in the fulfillment of this promise, and that they would be heirs together of the grace of God. And isn't that what happens in this chapter? The promise of grace being added to both of them. And what was that grace to be seen in? It was to be seen in the grace of life. And ultimately, of course, that's eternal life. But for Abraham and Sarah in this chapter, their bodies were to be physically quickened with life again in order that that child might be brought forth. That your prayers be not hindered, says Peter. And we're going to find later on in the story that I believe that it was the prayers of Abraham that finally brought faith to his wife Sarah. So you see, we've said that wives need to learn submission. But here's the other side of the ledger now, you see. Husbands have got to learn sacrifice. You know, when Paul expounds marriage in Ephesians, he says, husbands, that you've got to love your wives, even as Christ loved the ecclesia and gave himself for it. And I think the problem that a lot of husbands have is they say, wow, you know, that's pretty big. All Christ did was gave his life for the ecclesia. And it's such a big thing that husbands don't quite know how to actually take up this spirit of sacrifice. How do you sacrifice? Well, you see, I think Peter makes it easy, really. You see, Peter breaks the idea down. He says, you want to know what sacrifice is? He says, I'll tell you what it is. You've got to dwell with them according to knowledge. You've got to give honour to your wife. You've got to appreciate that she's the weaker vessel, and you've got to dwell together as heirs of the grace of life. That's sacrifice. You learn those things, says Peter, to her husband, and you've learnt the principles of sacrifice. So what are they? And by the way, you know, one of the interesting things in this record is that from the moment Genesis 17 stops, in every single incident that now follows on, you'll find that Abraham shows care for his wife. I think he learned it out of this chapter, you see. He shows care for his wife in every single episode from now on. So what is it? Well, firstly, says Peter, dwell with them according to knowledge. So husbands have got to spend time with their partners in scriptural matters. That's not just necessarily doing the readings with the children. It's talking about the truth. It's talking about the principles of the truth. It's talking about the principles of the truth in all the circumstances of daily life. Actually, wives need to communicate, don't they? I read something somewhere about the fact that a woman actually needs to get out more words per day than a man. And sometimes when a husband comes home, there is a sense of one could be convinced of the truth of that, shall we say. So dwelling with them according to knowledge means spending time to communicate the one with the other in order that the wife's faith and her own knowledge and conviction might be increased. Now, when we first got married, which was only a short while ago really, and you want to start your married life off so well, don't you? Everything's got to be perfect. That's a good way to start, by the way. Everything's got to be perfect. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. And two other things before the sun went down that we wanted to do. Number one, you close the evening with prayer together. Isn't that dwelling according to knowledge? Husband and wife concluding the day with prayer. And the other thing we did is we like to read a book at night time. We read just a few pages in bed before we went to sleep, and they were some of the happiest books and the happiest hours of time that we ever spent reading those books. And there's a sense of sharing and intimacy, and a wife needs that. She needs her husband to dwell with her according to knowledge, and she also needs him to give honour unto the wife. She needs his esteem. She needs his courtesy. She needs his thoughtfulness. She needs his care. The man has to learn to give honour to his wife in the way he actually thinks and acts towards her, that he esteems her as precious. Even in a romantic sense, I don't think that that's silly. I don't think it matters how long you've been married. I think that a woman always likes to be told by her husband that she's the most beautiful creature in the world. They always like that. There's a sense of honour, you see, that a man ought to have for his wife. And it's a terribly nourishing thing. And, says Peter, you've also got to appreciate that she's the weaker vessel. So what does that mean? Less brains? No. Because Genesis tells us that a man and a woman stand as equal before God in the matters of salvation. And there are some highly intelligent women and some highly unintelligent men. So a woman's not the weaker vessel in the sense of any mental incapacity. But I think what it's saying, you see, is that the makeup of a woman is different. She's a prey to emotions that a man doesn't have. Her physical makeup is more delicate. She's a creature of tenderness. She's a creature of gentleness. She's more vulnerable. And those very things which go to the makeup of a woman are her strengths as well as her weaknesses, because it's part of the maternal spirit that's planted within womankind. But it makes her gentle. And her husband's got to appreciate that and therefore deal gently with her as the weaker vessel, and he's got to dwell with her as being heirs together of the grace of life, to realise that marriage is truly a combination of the two complementing one another, drawing on the skills and the abilities of each other. Husbands have got to learn how to sacrifice for their wives. And you see, brothers and sisters, isn't this true, that if a man learns to sacrifice for his wife, then he may reasonably expect the spirit of submission in return. But you see, the moment a man demands submission as of right, then he's missed the whole point of apostolic exhortation, because Paul doesn't say that sacrifice is a right that a wife can demand, and Paul doesn't say that submission is a right that a husband can demand. Paul says that sacrifice is a duty that a husband should perform. And Paul says that submission is a virtue that a wife ought to show. But if anything, I think the onus always rests on the husband first to show leadership. And therefore a husband ought to learn the principle of sacrifice first, if he seeks that spirit of loving cooperation and submission from his wife. It's not the big things of life, you know, that count for sacrifice, it's the little things. You know, one of the main things to find out how to sacrifice it for a wife is to ask her what she wants. sometimes, you know, it's a terribly little thing, some annoying thing around the house that she's really actually wanted fixed for about, 3 years now. And she'd be thrilled if you fixed that. She would count that a sacrifice if you would just do that little thing. Brothers that are married, sacrifice isn't not communicating with your wife on spiritual things, but buying her an occasional posy of flowers. That's not sacrifice. Sacrifice isn't never having prayers together, but having the occasional fling at a restaurant. Sacrifice isn't dwelling together with her and spending time with her in scriptural things, or not doing that, but suddenly going on an expensive holiday. They never make up for those other things, do they? That's not sacrifice. Sacrifice is these things. Dwell with her according to knowledge, give honour unto the wife, respect her tenderness and gentleness, and appreciate that you're heirs together with regard to the hope of the grace of life to come. And Abraham now was going to have to take up those principles and to encourage his wife that she might now reach the climax of faith together with him, that they might now expect and anticipate the birth of this beloved son. Embracing the covenant blessing together. El Shaddai is all sufficient to nourish us unto fruitfulness. Whilst faith is essential, salvation only comes by the operation of divine grace. Fruitfulness in spiritual things comes by cutting off the flesh. Men and women are equal fellow heirs of the salvation offered in Christ, coordinate in the plan of redemption through the Son. Abraham learnt to develop the spirit of sacrifice, and Sarah was to learn that God would bless her. Faith is a belief in a power greater than our own that is able to perform that which is humanly impossible. And so he will, brothers and sisters. He'll perform in our own lives as well that which is humanly impossible if we will but have faith in him and rest in the confidence of his promises. And ye, his saints, rejoice his praises to declare, whose mercy calls you from the dust, their blessedness to share. For soon he will reveal himself in his dear Son to seal the covenants of truth and perfect all in one.